Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults. Here are your hosts, Judy Davis and Sandy Fowler.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I'm Sandy Fowler, here flying solo today and loving doing the Mighty Parenting podcast and sharing all these great guests with you. If you like what you're getting here, be sure to like, share, and comment and subscribe on iTunes or our website, mightyparenting.com, or your favorite podcast player, and share it with other parents. That's how most people find out about us. But also be sure to visit mightyparenting.com because we have more there to support you than just the podcast. Today, we are talking about pain, anxiety, and the brain. We all experience pain, but sometimes it becomes more problematic than just being an irritant or an inconvenience for a day or a week. Sometimes we end up with chronic pain, and that can take over our lives, or one family member's pain can take over the entire family's life. Oftentimes, and I know I thought of it this way, you know, we think of chronic pain as being something that adults or the elderly are dealing with. But physical chronic pain is up over 800% in kids. There was a 2015 paper today's guest mentioned that reported there were 1.7 million children in the U.S. alone suffering from chronic pain. And that number, 1.7 million kids, that was just staggering for me. And then when you start factoring in anxiety and emotional pain, those numbers escalate even more dramatically. So this chronic pain can cause a wide variety of problems. But what if the pain isn't just what we think it is? What if there's something we could do about it? We're going to be discussing this today with Dr. David Hanscom. Dr. Hanscom is a board-certified orthopedic surgeon specializing in surgical correction of complex spinal problems. And a significant part of his practice was devoted to performing surgery on patients who'd undergone multiple prior spinal surgeries. But he found that many patients who came to him showed no physical cause for the chronic pain they experienced. So around 2001, he began to share his own stress management tools with his patients who were in pain but had no indications for surgery. By 2006, a structured spine treatment protocol evolved from his own experience escaping from chronic pain. He published the book Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain, that is the basis for the program, and he created the website backincontrol.com, which is the action plan for the DOC project, which is Direct Your Own Care. Now he's focusing his efforts on bringing effective medical treatments for chronic mental and physical pain back into mainstream medicine. So Dr. Hanscom, thank you so much for joining the Mighty Parenting community today.
Thank you, Sandy. I'm very, very excited to be here.
And we've had some really good chats going on before we even got to the air. And you also shared in your book, but you yourself suffered from chronic pain and other physical symptoms as well. And so I was wondering if you would mind just sharing with us what happened with you.
Well, I'm going to preface the conversation by just saying one thing. If there's only one point to remember out of this entire podcast, is that anxiety is just the sensation generated by the body's stress chemicals. That's it. It's part of the unconscious, it is an unconscious survival response, which is a million times stronger than the conscious brain. It is not subject to psychological interventions because it's this massive neurochemical survival response. That explains how I get in trouble myself, is that I had a tough childhood. I had an abusive childhood. My mother was psychotic, essentially looking backwards, extremely abusive to all four of the kids and her husband. And we had a tough time. And at age 15 years old, I sort of shut the door on my life and just moved out of the house, essentially. Went to boarding school, went to college, never turned back. But I didn't realize the amount, the toll that took on me. And what happens when you come from a chaotic family, you're in a hyper-vigilant alert state all the time. but you also think it's normal because what else do you know? And what happened is that my coping mechanism, I would say, would be overachieving. So I was straight A students, I worked construction work, I played sports, I was very social. And I define myself sort of by my achievements and accomplishments, et cetera, because I had no place else to go. I had nothing really from my past. And it took me right up into medical school, residency, fellowship. And then the spine fellowship that I took was actually considered one of the top three in the world at the time that I took it. I didn't get there by being a wimp. I mean, my attitude was actually bring it on. I'm really, really tough. And I was. I could take I could take any stress, bring it on. And I was always challenged by stress. But then one day in 1990, I was driving across the Lake Washington Bridge and I had a panic attack. I didn't even know what anxiety was until that moment in time, but I went from no anxiety to a panic attack. I do want to say at this point that mental threats and physical threats are processed in the same part of the brain. They have the same area of the brain that's lit up. They have the same chemical response. Emotional pain and physical pain are the same pain. They're processed in the same area, same response. Your body can't tell the difference. And for me, psychologically, I'd been through counseling. I'd been married. I was very open to all sorts of ideas and coaching, whatever. But I went from really understanding my childhood and really working through the issues, et cetera, to a panic attack. And for the next 13 or 14 years, it was just a nightmare. And when I developed chronic pain, basically, it turns out that the mental pain or emotional pain is actually the bigger problem than the physical pain. So it depends how you define chronic pain. The problem is what happens, again, anxiety is the sensation generated by the body's stress chemicals, adrenaline, cortisol, histamines, and then your body's on hyper high alert. And I use that adrenaline drive to become, quote, successful. But the same adrenaline that took me up the hill took me right down the other side. When I went through the panic attack, I didn't have any extra undue stress. I mean, I had stress every day, all the time. It's extremely stressful being a spine surgeon, but so what? That's what I did. I actually prided myself in how much stress I could take and keep moving forward. It turns out, again, mental threats are more of a problem than the physical threats because humans can't escape their thoughts. You either can experience them, which creates a lot of mental distress, or suppress them, which I did, and that was the essence of the problem, or mask them with some type of addictive behavior, which works while you're in the action, but obviously long-term addictive behavior is a problem. But what my situation was, I honestly was very tough. I honestly did not know what the word anxiety meant. And I went from that to a panic attack. And what a panic attack is your body gets flooded with these stress chemicals. You develop extreme anxiety. I started to sweat. I felt like I was going to faint. My stomach went up in knots. And this is at 10 o'clock at night driving on a bridge, which, by the way, is a very typical place for a panic attack to start. But what it is this, you're getting a fight or flight response, but there's no threat. And then what happens, once that happens, it was just a disaster. I started having multiple panic attacks. I started developing extreme anxiety. And then since you can't escape your thoughts, your body is constantly full of stress chemicals. So I developed 17 of these potential 30 symptoms of chronic pain. In other words, that chemical change in the body translates into physical symptoms. And so it was a nightmare.
It's such a difficult thing to handle, but I want to go back and just touch on a couple of things you talked about, because I think these are really important. In our current culture, we love overachievers. We tell them they're doing great, and kids do well in school, and we say, "You're doing great, do more, fabulous job." And we never consider that the child who is actually overachieving is using that as a coping mechanism for handling the stress in their life. And I know in our suicide prevention work, that's one of the categories of kids that absolutely take people by surprise. Is, you know, they were a straight A student, they were on student council, they were an athlete, they did all these great things, and they just couldn't take it anymore. So when you talked about that idea, it kind of struck me, and I just wanted to take that moment to say, yes, sometimes overachieving is actually a coping mechanism. And you said by doing that, you know, yeah, you used that and you had it help you, but you ended up with 17 different physical symptoms? And we don't want to go through a list here, but what are some of those physical symptoms that we can end up with, that we can experience that are really coming from the stress and anxiety of our lives?
Well, again, your body is full of stress chemicals, adrenaline, cortisol, and histamines. And what those chemicals do is they shut down the blood supply to the bladder, to the bowel, and to the brain. Then, so one of the symptoms is migraine, headaches, irritable bowel, spastic bladder. PTSD is a classic adrenalized, you get an over-adrenalized response to a simple threat in the current situation. In other words, if a current situation reminds you of something in the past, when you're raised in a difficult past, more things are a threat in the present. So PTSD is a classic symptom of the problem, which I had. I had back pain, neck pain. I developed ringing in my ears, tinnitus, because what happens, the adrenaline doubles the nerve connection. My ears started to ring. And again, with all these symptoms and being a physician, nobody could tell me what was going on. But the reality is this is actually high school science. We go to medical school for a long time, learn incredible things about the human body. But we all know the fight or flight response that you learn in high school, that when you're threatened, either physically or mentally, your body's going to respond to chemical response. Is that feeling generated is what we call anxiety. Right now, medicine's missed it because we look at anxiety as the problem, it's the result. Anxiety actually is the pain. Whether it's mental pain or physical pain, either one of those cause anxiety. People can step on a tack or whatever it is, and it bothers them and they don't like it, but it can come and go in a second. They don't necessarily have anxiety. And what I found out in my own experience, of all the symptoms I had, the unrelenting anxiety was absolutely, by far and away, intolerable, beyond words. And then what anxiety does, it drives people into depression. And I want to go into the neuroscience, which you just said about the high achievers. There's a lot of neuroscience around this right now, is that Lisa Feldman Barrett, written in a book, How Emotions Are Made, documented with human consciousness that thoughts and concepts become embedded in a brain the same way that a chair or a table does. In other words, there's nothing about a chair or a table that says it's not a chair or a table because your eyes say it so. It's because your brain unscrambled the signals that came in through your eyes and said, yeah, this is a chair, this is a table, this is white, this is black, this is green. But it's all from the brain unscrambling the signals. What happens with humans, that's why abstract thinking doesn't really come into place until the teenage years and really not deeply till the 20s, that those thoughts and concepts we have about our lives actually become embedded in our brain as deeply as every other part of our reality. I used to say that thoughts are real because they create a chemical reaction in your body, but it turns out I'm wrong. It turns out that thoughts are not only real, they're your version of reality, and they create real physical responses, and each person has their own story based on their own past. And that's why your past has so much to do with the present, because all of us are programmed by our past. And so when you look at a chair or table, you don't even see the same thing, particularly if you use a word like Democrat or Republican or whatever, there's no way you or I think the same thing with either one of those words because we have a completely different past. So the key issue here with high achievers, I wrote this website post last week called Success is Just a Story. And by the way, so is failure. We get these stories in our mind about what we should be doing to be successful that becomes embedded in our brain. And what drives us to be successful is this negativity that I'm not good enough, not good enough, not good enough. That becomes its own story that carries over into every aspect of our life. You can't really enjoy your life if you're always not good enough.
Right. And even our high achievers feel they're not good enough. We talked in one of our episodes where these kids are facing global competition, you know, where you and I competed with the kids in our classroom or our neighborhood or our siblings. Today's kids, even when they're doing amazing things, think they're still not good enough.
Absolutely. So when you enjoy your life, if you can't enjoy life, being a teenager, young, healthy, the whole future in front of you, lots of friends, etc., when you get to enjoy your life, it doesn't get easier, as you well know, as you get older. And I think it's an incredible tragedy because, as you know, teenagers these years have way more opportunities than we dreamed of when we were kids. But that story of achievement is given to us by industry, by marketing, retailing, our parents. Everybody expects us to compete. And it's absolutely flawed. I don't know if you saw my website post called The Myth of Self-Esteem. Did you see that by chance?
I haven't read that one. I've had so much great material from you. I haven't made it through that one. So what does that tell us?
Okay, years ago, as you know, parents think that their one of the main goals in life is to teach kids to learn self-esteem. And I'll say unequivocally, parents' role is to provide nurturing, protection, a sense of safety, and life skills. They are not intended to teach self-esteem. And here's the reason why. When your identity is based on your accomplishments and your looks and whatever you do, then you're dependent on outside circumstances for your peace of mind. And you're at the mercy of those circumstances. Then you go into the school system where everybody has the same problem. So what we're doing, instead of actually nurturing and supporting each other, we're actually competing right from the beginning, which creates tremendous anxiety. And the self-esteem makes it worse because the idea is that if I have enough self-esteem, somehow I'll be happier. But remember, you're using a conscious means to deal with these massive unconscious circuits. And you're actually creating more stress chemicals, not less. And so the anxiety goes up. Remember, anxiety is a result, not the cause of the problem. Your body's now full of these stress chemicals. You have ongoing anxiety. Then as you compete more and more and more, and you try harder and harder and harder to increase your self-esteem, and it doesn't work, at a certain point, you become hopeless. Because what do? I'll never forget that I had been in practice for maybe 2 or 3 years, had a beautiful house, beautiful child, skiing powder up in the Sierras, and just anxious as could be. And what happened, I go, wait a second, I've done everything I'm supposed to do to become, quote, happy, and I'm miserable beyond words. What's going on here? And again, I was right in the middle of my downfall, so I had no idea really how to deal with this. But I had severe anxiety for 15 years. The last 7 of them developed into an obsessive compulsive disorder, which was a nightmare beyond words. The prognosis for that diagnosis, by the way, is horrible because, they try to treat it psychologically. But the literature says that it's not curable. And I'm here to say it's not only curable, I'm thriving at a level I never thrived at before. Anyway, bottom line is with self-esteem, it's a judgment pattern. So every second you're judging yourself better or worse than the person next to you or you're competing with or whatever. When you get to relax, you don't. So it's an ongoing judgment pattern that creates anxiety that doesn't stop. Plus, it's part of the conscious versus unconscious brain, so it doesn't work. It turns out that really self-esteem is possibly the worst myth ever propagated on the human experience. It's a disaster.
Okay, so I'm trying to tie things back now and go, you know, we started out with the idea of talking about chronic physical pain. And so I want to make sure I'm understanding where we're going with this. And if I'm understanding what you said, it was that chronic physical pain can come from anxiety because of the physical changes in our body that happen when we feel anxious, that releasing of adrenaline and cortisol and histamine, and chronically having our body flooded with that puts our nervous system into, I believe you call it a turbocharged state. Did I understand that correctly so far?
Close, but let me just read. We're very, very close. But this is a huge paradigm shift. This is the only point I want to make today. Okay, just picture your body full of stress chemicals.
Okay.
Let's say you're angry at your spouse for some whatever reason. You know, your body, your heart's racing, you're agitated, you're pacing the room, you're just agitated, right?
Mm-hmm.
And while you're in that state of mind, while your body chemistry is off and your heart might be racing or palpating and you might be sweating a little bit, your muscles might be tense, but you're not very happy, correct?
Right.
Okay. That point, just picture your body full of stress chemicals, that generates a feeling of anxiety. That's it. That's what anxiety is that sensation generated by your body being full of those chemicals.
Okay. So
that's it. It's not a cause of anything. It's just a symptom of your body being full of stress chemicals. It's a symptom. It's actually not a diagnosis.
Okay. I got it. And the little tweak was that I said the anxiety caused that, but it didn't cause it. Our anxiety happens when our body is flooded with the stress chemicals.
Right. So it's a feedback loop. When you feel anxious, you know that your body's full of stress chemicals. The reasons we can talk about later, but
right.
That's the issue is that's your, and then it gets a little bit deeper than that because remember, anxiety actually is the pain.
Well, and I love what you just said. When you feel anxious, that tells you your body is full of stress chemicals. Because it's like, okay, that's something simple that I can understand. I can go, oh, wait, I'm feeling like this. This is what's happening.
Right.
And when that continually happens, then when we are continually or frequently in that physical state where we are flooded with those chemicals, then what happens to our bodies?
Well, then you have two things happening. So again, since mental threats and physical threats are processed in the same area of the brain, same circuits, you have the same chemical response, you're going to have one of these 30 symptoms. Okay, so what happens is that your body's full of stress chemicals, since it shuts down the blood supply to the bowel, you may have irritable bowel disease. If you have spastic bladder or the burning sensation, all these physical symptoms occur because remember, every organ in your body is going to respond differently to this body full of stress chemicals. In other words, every cell in your body, which is, by the way, 50 trillion of them, every cell in your body is bathed by adrenaline, cortisol, and histamines and other stress chemicals. Same thing with the immune system is that when you're under stress, well, your immune system goes way off. People get allergies. I develop skin rashes all over my whole body, off and on, would come and go for 15, 20 minutes and disappear. My scalp would itch, my feet would burn. All sorts of things happen because the histamines are way off also. Remember, when your body has stress chemicals, all of us know this, when you're scared, your heart races. Well, how did that happen? It happened because you had an adrenaline surge in your bloodstream. Your autonomic nervous system in the form of the sympathetic nerve went to the heart and increased the heart rate. So I shouldn't say it's entirely a chemical response. It's also the autonomic nervous system that actually helps make this whole process work. In other words, those stress chemicals come from someplace. It's your autonomic nervous system that regulates the secretion of those chemicals. So you get this autonomic response where your whole body's on high alert, which it should be. From a survival standpoint, it works beautifully. But remember, most living creatures don't have consciousness. And that's what I call the curse of consciousness, is that we can't escape it. And I think the basis of chronic pain, by the way, is this inability to escape our thoughts. And then it translates into chemical changes, which translates into multiple physical symptoms. You're having all these physical symptoms, and the source seems to be unclear. It's completely clear. I mean, if your heart's racing and you're scared, what's the source of your symptoms? Right?
Right, yeah.
Okay, so that's the key issue. This is high school science.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Just not the way that we are traditionally told about it or the way that we go about approaching it. You know, we have a pain and we go see our doctor and we expect the doctor to fix that specific pain and we expect it to be fixed by dealing with that part of the body. You know, we go see a specialist because there's a pain in the knee when it can be something else. It's the same thing you're talking about, but I know at one point my husband was a runner and he was having knee pain. And he went to see our chiropractor and they did an MRI and checked some different things and his knees were great. Everyone's like, oh yeah, you're a runner. Of course you had bad knees. He had no deterioration in his knees, but he had rolled his ankle so many times, he'd build up a bunch of scar tissue, which was pushing on the knee. So most people would go to an orthopedic surgeon and say, hey, I have a problem with my knee. And that wasn't it. And that, to me, that's kind of what you're telling us now is, yeah, you're going to say, I have a pain in my back and I need to go to see my spine surgeon. And this is chronic pain. There's nothing else we can do. Surgery must be the answer. And you're saying you found that no, for many people, that chronic pain has nothing to do with a surgical solution. It's about the over anxious body, about the turbocharged nervous system that's been running these chemicals through our body and pushing our autonomic nervous system to create some of these other 30 physical symptoms.
Correct. Okay. Now you're dead on.
Okay.
But let me ask you a question from my perspective, because we've had a couple conversations, but this really is a pretty big paradigm shift for you, correct?
It is. It's the interesting thing for me is that I think about health and wellness differently from a lot of people. But yes, this specific idea that chronic physical pain came from a essentially what we would normally think of as a mental well-being, yes, that is a paradigm shift, as I imagine it is for many of the people you talk to.
Well, it's a huge paradigm shift, but the other paradigm shift that's, I think, more critical is the fact that anxiety is not primarily a psychological problem.
Yes, I think that is definitely a very different way of thinking about it. And the place that you can probably sense I'm still thinking, part of my brain is back there chewing on something. And what it's chewing on is, I understand what you said to us about the anxiety is the result. So your example of I'm angry with my husband and the feelings that I feel are the anxiety. But what my brain is chewing on is, okay, what causes the anger? Like, what's that first step? I feel like we're starting in the middle.
Yeah, that's a perfect question, because I think you know my lines that basically anger and anxiety are the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, the antidote to anxiety is control. In other words, you develop the sensation that is so unpleasant, it compels you to take protective action, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you take protective action, situation resolved, stress chemicals drop, anxiety goes away, and you're fine, right?
Right.
If you can't control a situation yourself to escape the whatever's causing the anxiety, then when you're trapped by anything, relationships, circumstances, pain, whatever, the body secretes more stress chemicals to try to enhance the chances of escape. And you all know in situations where you require an extra physical force to get that adrenaline surge to solve the problem, it's a survival mechanism that works, right?
Right.
But remember, with mental threats, you can't escape your thoughts. You can suppress them, mask them, or experience them, but you're trapped. You're trapped by your thoughts, correct?
Yeah, they're just always there.
When your body secretes more adrenaline, cortisol, and histamines and other stress chemicals to try to escape, and then you become angry. And what happens, anger is again, the sensation, it's a symptom of very elevated stress chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens, it shifts down the blood supply to the frontal lobe of the brain, because it's about survival at this point. And people don't think clearly, of course, when they're angry. It's a massive survival response. It's completely primitive survival reflex. It's not rational. We all know when people are angry, nothing good happens. And it's a huge problem. So remember, the antidote to anxiety is control. When you lose control, you secrete more stress chemicals and become angry. And that's hence the problem right now. What drives the anger is this uncontrolled anxiety. I like to talk about just in the school system, how that plays out in school, because there's some research that's been done on this. And what they found out, that kids who are bullied have elevated levels of inflammatory markers compared to kids who are not bullied. And the test that they measure is called a C-reactive protein. They found out that the kids that were bullied had elevated levels of C-reactive protein. And it's sort of a big problem, because when you have elevated inflammatory markers, it causes coronary artery disease, autoimmune disorders, by the way, are linked to stress, et cetera. There's all sorts of diseases that occur when you have elevated inflammatory markers. And so it's disturbing. And then what they found out, which is even more disturbing to me, is that the bullies actually had lower levels of inflammatory markers than the kids that were normal. In other words, it's a physiological reward for bullying, because remember, more power, more control, right?
Right.
And so what happens from a physiological standpoint, there's a physiological reward to having more power, more control. And that's why it's actually a physiological reward for being a bully.
And especially on top of the fact that oftentimes our bullies are living in a situation where they feel like they don't have control.
Absolutely.
So that would, I would guess that that would even make that more, I was going to say appealing, but that's not the word, but that would be even more of a reward to them, as they went from this high anxiety, no control space to that physical reward of having control. And so it's not just that they got control in that place. It's also that differential between being way out of control to being way in control.
Correct. And then you add into, that's why I'm so upset about the self-esteem thing, because remember, you're going to school, you're based on always being taught that self-esteem is a big deal. The way we get a self-esteem is by getting approval from others. The way we gain more self-esteem is by withholding approval of others, or even step further, bullying. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't actually work, because I don't think bullies are necessarily happy people. In fact, we sort of know they're not. If you're chronically angry, anxious, and upset, you really are not a happy person, right? And it's been shown in multiple arenas that really your capacity to enjoy life is based on your chemical makeup. Remember, if your body's full of oxytocin, the love drug, serotonin, antidepressant, dopamine, the reward drug, there's a group of drugs called the GABA drugs, which are similar to Valium. They're anti-anxiety drugs. When you're at play, enjoying your friends and family, and relaxing, your body is full of these chemicals, then you feel relaxed. Remember, relaxation, again, is a symptom. It's a feeling generated by these relaxation chemicals. We don't say relaxing's a psychological problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just like anxiety, again, it's a sensation generated by the opposite set of chemicals. Just like we wouldn't be calling relaxing a psychological issue, anxiety also is not a psychological issue. It's just the way the body, it's just a symptom of the body's chemistry. In the case
Could you say that? Just say that again. I think that's, you've said it a couple different ways, but this is such an important concept. If you could just repeat that.
Our sense of well-being isn't dependent on self-esteem and power and control. It's really dependent on a given day on your body's chemical makeup. When you're full of drugs that cause you to feel relaxed, you know, again, the oxytocin, dopamine, serotonin, and the GABA drugs, you feel great. If your body's full of these hypervigilant stress chemicals, you feel anxious and frustrated and hyper alert, you don't feel very good. We all know that. Basically, your sense of it, your capacity to enjoy your life really depends on your chemical makeup. It's also the essence of the solution, is that you learn how to regulate your own body's chemistry.
Right. And then you followed that up with anxiety is not a psychological problem.
Right. Again, I know I'm being a little bit silly here, or repetitive, but again, you're not trying to fix anxiety. You're just trying to regulate your body's chemistry. So if you're anxious, you realize, okay, my body's full of stress chemicals. Then there's a whole bunch of very effective, simple tools that actually decrease the body's stress chemicals. Again, when your body's full of stress chemicals actually doubles the nerve conduction, you really do feel pain more, because guess what? You're hyper-alert, you're hypersensitized, your body wants to protect you, and your perception of pain changes dramatically when you're under stress. That's what it's supposed to do. And again, when you flow relaxation or play chemicals, the opposite occurs, where you feel great, feel young, feel vigorous, feel alert. Remember, anxiety, anger shut down the blood supply to the frontal lobe of the brain. You don't think very clearly. In fact, we also know that when people in chronic pain have their brains actually physically shrink, and when you treat chronic pain effectively, it actually physically changes. There's a term called neuroplasticity, where your brain changes by the millisecond. Every second, as we've talked and learned new ideas and traded ideas, that your brain just changed. New connections, new neurons, new glial cells, new whatever. I mean, your brain changes every second. In medical school, we didn't think the brain changed at all. There's 80 billion cells in your brain. They're changing every millisecond. There's all sorts of electrical activity taking place at a level we have no idea that we'll probably never comprehend at a human level. But your brain's changing. And what happens is that if you use the neuroplastic capacities of the brain, you literally can train your brain to go a different direction. What doesn't work, by the way, is positive thinking, which is another way of suppressing negative thinking. Positive thinking is one of the ultimate disasters in treating all this stuff. You can't treat stress by positive thinking. Not going to work.
It's interesting as you talk about this, because I recently had a micro experience about this. So just had a lot of busyness and stress in, you know, three of the high stress areas of your life, and just a lot happening, a lot going on. And of course, then I don't make the time to do the things that I would typically do to help take care of myself and that help keep my physical chemistry in balance and take care of my mental, emotional well-being. So that exacerbates things. And I was getting really nervous about just how much mental capacity I felt like I was losing, like trying to do our interviews where I'm listening and I'm thinking and I'm taking notes and I'm trying to keep track of two or three different things. I couldn't do it. I'm going to events and I'm trying to take notes while I'm listening to what the presenter's saying, and I couldn't hold four words in my head long enough to write them down. Then I left town. We have several of these stressors resolved themselves. I left town to work for 10 days, but I was out of all of the typical, just normal daily stuff you have to do, your normal daily stressors, away from any remaining stressors, and I had more time to take care of me. 10 days later, I came home and realized I had my brain back again.
Yep.
It was just so interesting to see that happen in this short time span where I was truly, seriously worried about my memory, and to just have that powerful of an example in my own life of it's not your memory, it's taking care of yourself. And so you need to make time for these things. And that's actually one of the things I want to ask you. So what can we do to keep those chemical levels at a healthy balance?
First of all, I think what we should do is, I know we're going to have several more podcasts going on some of the details, but I can give your listeners some homework to do if you want. And the key here is to understand that you can't control this stuff. The first step is becoming aware that it's happening, and then you have to allow yourself to create the different alternative responses. But the essence of the solution is you decrease the body's adrenaline and cortisol and histamines. And there's two ways of doing that. One of them is directly through relaxation, mindfulness, meditation, exercise. On a given moment, those actually directly decrease the body's chemicals. And they've been shown to work over and over and over again. But I think more importantly, again, using the concept of neuroplasticity, you train your brain to actually become less reactive to the stress. Instead of being stress automatic survival response, is stress choice response. And what happens is you create a little bit of a space and start substituting. In other words, positive thinking doesn't work. It's a way of suppressing negative thinking, but positive substitution works beautifully.
What do you mean by that? What's positive substitution?
In other words, like for instance, cognitive behavioral therapy, you start thinking, well, I'm not good enough. I should have done this faster. Well, the should word is one of the cognitive distortions. The more appropriate thing was, well, my brain says I should be doing this faster, but guess what? I did a reasonable job. And I'm going to move forward. So what happens, Dr. Bernstein's book, Feeling Good, put out 10 cognitive distortions that we all do. Emotional reasoning, emphasizing the negative, minimizing the positive, etc. Should is a horrible problem. Labeling is another problem. You know, you learn all these things that create this unpleasant chemical response. Most of them aren't rational. And so we become aware of the thought. You create a little bit of a space, and then you become aware of what an appropriate response might be. As you substitute over and over and over again, your brain starts to change. Or you simply program your brain to sort of be with unpleasant circumstances. And we can talk about this on the next podcast, but forgiveness is a huge thing. Remember, anger and anxiety are the same thing. If you want to hold on to a past grudge, guess what? That person situation now has complete control over your life. But going back to the homework, is what I'd recommend is a couple things. One of them is, my website's backincontrol.com. And if you don't get to the book, Back in Control, at least get to the website. It's open source, no registration required, no emails required. And go to stage one, which is called laying the foundation, and there's five steps. First one is learning about pain, which you're starting to do today. The second one is called expressive writing. I would encourage everybody listening just to do this today. You do it right now. Just take a piece of paper, write down a minute or two, just thoughts, any thoughts, positive or negative, and you tear them up. And remember, neuroplasticity is a process of awareness, separation, and reprogramming. And again, what you're doing to decrease reactivity of your brain, you want to change the actual structure of your brain. So what the writing does, you have an awareness of the unpleasant thoughts, whatever they are, or pleasant, doesn't really matter. And you can't control your thoughts, but you're simply separating from them. The paper's on the table, you're away from the paper. That space is connected with vision and feel. And then you tear it up instantly for two reasons. One of them is to write with freedom. The second one is to not analyze these thoughts. All these issues seem to be coming up, but they're not issues. They're just thoughts. To me, the writing is just a metaphor for separating from your thoughts. Again, you can't control them. The third thing is called active meditation. Remember, neuroplasticity is awareness, separation, reprogramming. And right this very second, just feel where you're sitting for a second, drop your shoulders. And for about 3 to 5 seconds, multiple times a day, just put your brain on a different sensation. What you've done instead of having these racing thoughts or pain sensations, you simply switch sensations. Taste your food, feel the breeze, feel the steering wheel, whatever it is, just simply listen, feel, touch, whatever it takes for 3 to 5 seconds multiple times a day. That's a reprogramming tool. The next one is sleep is huge. Chapter 14 of my book is all about sleep. Again, a bunch of suggestions you can do on your own. The final one, which has been extraordinarily powerful and interesting, is never discussing your pain, because that's where your attention is going to develop. In other words, your brain, you can't control your brain, but you can direct it. Your brain will develop wherever you place its attention. If your attention is on the pain or complaining or whatever it is, that's where your brain is going to develop. So we've held a workshop back at Omega every year, and we learned at the workshop that people discuss their pain all the time. The problem is your brain's on that subject. One of the most powerful ways to start breaking the pain cycle is simply not discussing it.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you just because I'm laughing over here. So I went to a resiliency training recently, and they were talking about some of these similar concepts, and they were talking about focus in that. And the doctor who was running it, Mike, said he had an accident and had a fairly severe facial injury right around his eye. And unfortunately, his son had to go to the emergency room with him. I think his son was around 7 or so. And so, you know, Mike's sitting there, he's in all this pain, and his son's like, "That really hurts, huh, Dad? It looks like it really hurts." And the guy's like, "Well, yeah, it really hurts." He goes, "Well, is there another part of your body you can think about that doesn't hurt?" Which is, you know, the boy taking it what Dad said. So I'm sitting in church last weekend. I was on the road again, and I had an irritation on my arm that was just creating that deep, deep itching that scratching doesn't help with. And, you know, you end up damaging your skin. So I'm trying not to touch it. And like you said, I'm thinking about it and it's itching and itching. So I went, "Okay, Sandy, is there another part of your body that doesn't itch?" And then I'm like, "Well, that wasn't working well." So I was like, "Okay, we're going to move our toes." And I just started focusing on that. And within 2 minutes, I didn't feel that horrible nerve irritation in my arm anymore.
Correct. Yeah, that's dead on.
No, so it's just those, again, one of those little micro experiences. And I realize that's not the same as an intense chronic pain, but our body functions the same way. So while it might take more retraining and more work to create a new neural pathway for something you've been experiencing longer and more intensely, that's still the way our body works. And it still does work.
Can I coach you for a second?
Sure.
I coach all my participants in this one thing. I said, try to take the word work out of this, because work implies you're trying to fix something.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Because what happens if you're trying to fix your pain, where's your attention?
On the pain.
Right. And so the key to this process is that I call it moving forward with your pain. Your goal is to create the vision of your life, whatever you want. The pain is irrelevant. And you, just like you pointed out, you put your attention on something else. Why is you focus on your vision and what you want, that's where your brain's going to develop. And you can work hard to achieve that goal, but if you're going to work on trying to fix the pain and become a better person, you can't do it. You just can't do it. And the metaphor I've been using recently, which has been really powerful for people, is that if you're going to learn a language, let's say like Spanish, you go to class, you'll do repetitions, you might go to the country, but let's, for discussion's sake, say in 5 years you can speak Spanish. What happened to your brain?
Created new neural pathways.
Change, right? People yes. forget that to learn a new language or learn a new skill, music, whatever, your brain changes. And those are embedded pathways, right?
Mm-hmm.
You didn't learn Spanish by trying not to speak English.
Right? True.
Okay. So remember, so I call it learning another language. The new language is what I call an enjoyable life. And what happens, you create a vision of what your life should look like, what you want it to look like, and you just keep working, practicing, going to that direction. So again, it's not positive thinking, but it's positive substitution, positive vision, and just repetition starts heading you that direction. It's similar to directing a river into a different channel, right?
Mm-hmm.
The default language is survival. and all these stress chemicals. I mean, one of my colleagues pointed out the human body's responsibility is to survive, period, end of story. That's it. It's not designed to have a good time. The reason why I have consciousness that evolved because the creatures that could cooperate with each other survive. In other words, social skills are a survival skill, but we're not inherently designed to have a great time. That's a luxury. And what you can do once you recognize, so you had to become aware of the automatic response. Remember, to create neuroplasticity, you have to become aware of what is. Okay, here's my chemical surge. You create a little bit of a space. That's what the writing does. And then you redirect. And there's an infinite ways of redirecting. There's a lot of ways of disconnecting. But the key is becoming aware that, okay, I feel anxious. I feel upset. There's simply a symptom that my body's full of stress chemicals. And by the way, if you don't feel anxious, guess what? Your body will physically react. In other words, I didn't feel anxiety for years. But guess what? My feet were burning. My ears were ringing. Remember, they go to the same circuits, had the same chemical surge. I was able to suppress the anxiety, but I wasn't able to suppress the physical reaction. Chronically elevated stress chemicals are going to manifest themselves somehow, either with the feeling of anxiety or anger or some physical symptom, because they go to the same circuits in the brain. Learning another language is like building a virtual desktop on your computer, and this new desktop doesn't necessarily have pain, at least the way we think about it.
Yeah, so the reason it sounded like I was thinking hard because I was. So here's where I'm going now as a parent. I'm saying, all right, so my child is experiencing some physical symptom. Do I take them to the doctor or do I start working on this 5-step process? What makes sense here? I don't want to harm my child by lack of care, and I don't want to harm my child by overdoing medical intervention when that's not the real problem.
I cannot give you a cut and dried answer to that because it really just depends. It's hard to know. I mean, I always work patients up. I don't assume anything. Sometimes if I'm pretty sure it's not a physical thing, I'll go through this process first. The symptoms drop down quickly. I won't do a huge workup. I'll often work up patients pretty quickly with scans just to make sure we're not missing something. Invariably, I find nothing. I don't think that trying to, you just have to sort of play the ball where it lies. I honestly don't have an answer for that.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think you and I talk about this, maybe discuss on the next podcast, that I work with lots of teenagers, and the first thing I do with the teens is I fire the parents. And You can't, because what happens if you're anxious about your kids, there's a process called mirror neurons that when you smile at a baby, the baby smiles back, not because the baby's happy, but because you stimulated that happy center of the brain. It's called mirror neurons. It's how mm-hmm. we learn. And what happens if you walk in the house in a bad mood, you now stimulated everybody else's brain in the house to be in a bad mood. Not psychological, it's a direct mirror neurons effect.
Right. If mama ain't happy, nobody's happy, right?
But it's not psychological.
Mm-hmm.
Really, yep. A direct neurological stimulation. And the key issue here is none of us like to be given advice, adults or kids, especially from their parents or their kids, either way. And you got to let go. You have to trust your kids to figure it out themselves. But the key issue is that the parents, if you really want to solve your kids' problems, is jump into the book, jump into the website, do your own work. That's it, and let go. The advice I give to parents all the time is that I want you to walk out of here, and whenever you walk in the door of your house, if you're in a bad mood, don't walk in the house because you're going to bring that energy into the house. Then of all, I want you to spend the next month not giving one piece of advice to your kids, not one. I don't want you to yell at them, et cetera, et cetera. Just actually be nice to your kids, no matter what. There's also a book out called Parent Effectiveness Training, which is still the number one book I've read in my entire life, written by Dr. Thomas Gordon in the 70s. And absolutely, it's just about communicating with your kids and actually learning to listen to them. It's the most incredible book I've ever read. I've probably read it at least 20 times. I read it when my son was about 18 months old, and it completely changed my life, changed his life also. But it's a really remarkable book that we certainly can discuss later. But the bottom line is, I boil my parenting advice down to one word, and that's the word play. Communications, respect, all those things that we know about, but we don't necessarily put into place. There's also some neurological reasons why parents yell at their kids and vice versa, because we plant our own triggers, but again, another discussion. But yeah, there's a whole bunch of rules in the family that come around from the neuroscience research that we just talked about. They're not very hard. They are behavioral changes. They're a little bit tricky because it takes a little bit of a paradigm shift. But we've had the best time the last 2 years working on the family issues. The family issues are not in the book. They're actually on the website only. I'm actually going to write a third book basically on healing the family's pain. But on stage one, below the fifth step, it says, click this link to begin your healing at home with your family. And it turns out that the family triggers the most powerful triggers keeping people in pain, but they're also the most powerful triggers pulling people out of pain. We've had the best time you can imagine with these family dynamics. It's been remarkable.
Yeah, it's funny you talk about the listening to your kids. Spoiler alert for any listeners who have not yet subscribed to our communication series tips, because that's the first tip they get is just stop talking and listen. Say nothing.
Yep.
Nod your head if you got to do something, but say nothing. And that's what we get complaints about. And people will stop reading after that first email because they don't like to hear it.
Yep.
But it's the hard truth that we have heard in various forms from different experts, and we're hearing from you again today, is we can't make another human being do anything. And yep. Now you've added to that to show us that not only can we not make our kids do something, but our attempts to make them do something are actually creating a physical problem inside their bodies. Yep. So again, we're going to say, mighty parents, remember our mantra, model it. I know I'm working with some of these techniques, and my goal is to get myself pulled together enough to be working on all of it and to stop pushing my family to do it. Because of course I got excited and went, oh, you guys, you should do this. And it's fine to say, hey guys, I found this really great stuff. If you want to read about it, here it is. I'm working on it. If you decide to, let me know and we can talk about it. And those two approaches, I did the two different approaches with different people in the family. Of course, the person I'm most anxious about, I went, you got to do this. And that didn't work well.
Nope.
The other one, this is out there. They didn't jump on board, but they're like, huh, interesting. And they'll watch me. And when they see this helping me and they get to be around a better, nicer, happier me, then hopefully that will pique their curiosity. And in the meantime, as you said, I'm creating that mirror neuron situation where what they get to mirror is good and happy and healthy, as opposed to chemical, you know, unpleasantly chemically induced nervous system.
Right.
And unfortunately today we're out of time, but as you know, as you've said, Dr. Hanscom, we're going to be doing a few more interviews. We will have one out probably again in just a couple of months. So I appreciate that you're spending so, so much time with us. And I just want to ask you to please give out the name of your book and the website again for anyone who wants to get that. And of course, it'll be in our show notes as well.
The book is Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain. The website is backincontrol.com. By the way, the whole process is about 90% self-directed, which has made it very exciting for people. You don't need big pain clinics. You don't need doctors other than being careful. But I really appreciate being on your show. This has been a lot of fun. I enjoy it.
Well, and we appreciate it too. And almighty parents out there, thank you for being here with us, for joining us today, and for being part of our community, whether it's on Facebook or in the membership. Absolutely love interacting with you. Don't forget mightyparenting.com has more resources for you. And if you're here and you're listening, you already are a mighty parent. We'll see you next week.